From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Nancy Piercy, professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, and author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Nancy Piercy in their conversation.
There was a huge mushrooming of reform movements in the 19th century. There were movements, well, there was the abolition movement against slavery, of course. There were movements against prostitution and sex trafficking. There were movements to help orphans. There were a host of movements. In fact, historians refer to this network of movements collectively as the Benevolent Empire. And most of them were won by women, because now that women, as I said earlier, had been made the moral guardians of society, they said, well, we've got to go out in public and solve these moral issues. Well, the trouble, of course, is that most of these movements, reform movements, were aimed at what were traditionally male vices, like drinking. Well, let me give a quote. So this is one of my favorite feminist quotes. A feminist historian says, there was little doubt as to the sex of the tavern keepers, the slaveholders, the drunkards, and the seducers. And so there was a tone, there was a sexual antagonism happening with these moral reforms as well. And unfortunately, what it meant is more and more society was just accepting that men were naturally lewd, rude, and crude, and that it was up to women to tame them. And so this double standard, I think it's still happening today. I was interviewed not long ago on a podcast with a young couple. And so this was my chance to find out how they thought, was the double standard still evident in the Christian church? And they said, oh, absolutely. In the dating scene, for example, they said, it is just expected that boys are always going to push the envelope sexually, that boys are going to be more prone to porn and other, sin and vice, and that it's up to women to be the gatekeepers, to hold the line, to make sure that they don't violate the moral standards. They said very much that same double standard they think is still in the church today. But it's good to know where it came from. It starts back with the Industrial Revolution, when men were no longer held responsible for their families in the same way.
And we're let off the hook. One of the points you make in this book as well that, I'm just calling these aha moments because there's so many of them, and I'm thinking about them as we're going through this podcast. But in the ancient world, people recognized that the rejection of abortion was to be pro-woman. In the contemporary world, to oppose abortion is seen as being anti-woman. That is a disjuncture that many people do not know about.
Yes, today we don't realize that abortion is essentially saying that a woman should be more like a man. That in order to make it in society today, women have to deny that which characterizes them most as women. Of course, as human, we share a lot of things in common with men. But as women, what's distinctive about women is, of course, that we are the ones who bear children. And unfortunately, I think the message for a long time has been, if women want to make it, if they want to have that interesting professional life, if they want to develop their skills, they have to be more like men. And what does that mean? That means they have to control their fertility. They have to be able to determine when they're going to have children. And, if the child comes at the wrong time, they have to have the right to abortion. And after their children are born, they have to have the right to daycare, preferably state-funded daycare, so that they could be just as available to the workplace as men are. And so to me, that sounds like an obvious denigration of women, because it's saying you don't have value unless you can function essentially as a man. And abortion is one of the key tools for that. So, and it's true. I mean, let's face it, pregnancy coming at an awkward time can be very difficult. I was in seminary when I became pregnant with my first child. And I was in crisis about it, to tell you the truth, because I didn't know how to pursue my deepest interest except through the academic world. Those are my interests. And I thought, having to drop out of seminary felt like falling into a black hole. No, it turned out I loved being a mother. I homeschooled my kids. I wanted more time with my kids. And I've worked part-time from home most of my career. But I can understand why women sometimes do find it difficult to have to drop out of a job or drop out of work or fall into poverty because they had a child. So, you know, we want to be understanding about this. But ultimately, the message that you must be like a man, who should adapt? I say the workplace should adapt, not the woman. I say the education system should adapt. You know, if women are the ones who have babies, we should adapt to that and not force them to feel like, well, you know, the only way you can accommodate is to drop out or have an abortion. I mean, so many women feel that way. So all that to say, we should change our society to be welcoming to children instead of changing women's biological functions so that they fit better into a male world.
You know, this is another, I didn't mean to get to this early, but that's another aha moment. You talk about the Industrial Revolution. It brought in the reform movements in general, brought so many problems to the table. And you say you can't really go back to the agrarian culture, but you can, because of technology, do things today that we weren't able to do, even in the agrarian culture. So you can bring men and women back into the home with equal responsibility in terms of rearing their children. So you can have a healthy family nucleus once again.
Yeah, I do think that the ideal is for both men and women to be able to do economically productive work while raising their children, which is what they did have prior to the Industrial Revolution. You know, since we've talked about feminism a bit, I mean, obviously, one reason for the feminist movement is that when men left, you know, when the Industrial Revolution took men's work out of the home, of course, it took women's work out of the home as well. You cannot be a Proverbs 31 woman in the same way, running all these businesses from home, or rather, that's been our assumption. I would like us to go back to saying, yes, you can. But I'll have a whole chapter on practical ways that we can maybe flex the workplace. People don't realize this, but surveys show that men report just as much work-family tension as women do. That many men do report feeling that constant grief that they're not as involved with their children as they would like to be. And so the pandemic had a very slight silver lining, which is that a lot of fathers discovered they did like being home more and being closer to their children. 65% of American fathers in one survey said they did not want to go back to the office full time when the pandemic ends. And the New York Times had an article titled something like, "During the pandemic, fathers got closer to their children and they don't want to lose that." I love that. So in the book, I give a lot of anecdotes. You know, that's about all you can do right now. It's just, here's anecdotes. Here's how various people have succeeded in creating a flexible workplace. One of my graduate students is married to an IT professional, and he came home during the pandemic. And because he was working from home, he was able to be more involved in their family's homeschooling. He decided he would be the one to make lunch every day. He was able to take his kids to soccer practice and choir practice. And he picked up so many of the family responsibilities that his wife was able to start a part-time business. She's an opera singer. I have a student who was an opera singer. And so she started a voice studio, and the whole family benefited from the additional income. So I interviewed her husband, and he said to me, "Our family is so much more balanced now. I am never going back to a cubicle." And the final kicker is, he said, "The time I used to spend commuting to work, I now spend praying with my wife." And I thought, okay, this is a great example that you can help people. I have several more examples, mostly my students who found ways. But I also had to quote CEOs, right? Because we have to convince the workplace that this is good as well. And it was interesting. I found CEOs who said, you know, we did not want to experiment with home-based work because we were afraid people were going to slough off and productivity would go down. And they said the pandemic has completely exploded that fear. We did not see a reduction in productivity. In fact, if anything, people work more when they work from home because they're not losing time commuting to work. They're not wasting as much time in unnecessary meetings and so on. People who work from home, you almost have to tell them to stop, right? So we have to help people to understand that this is a win-win for both sides. It's a win-win for businesses, as well as a win-win for families.
whenever I think of you, Nancy, I think of you sort of in harmony with Jay Richards, because both of you are masters at exploding mythology. So you take these myths and you explode them and you expose the utter bankruptcy of the mythology. I want you to take a moment to debunk the Romantic movement and the myth of the noble savage.
Yeah, so the reason this is relevant is, again, the Industrial Revolution was such a turning point. As men were no longer growing up in the farms and living outdoors and being, you know, hardy, strong farm boys, they were coming into the city and working in bureaucracies and working at desk jobs. People began to worry that men were becoming emasculated.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Nancy Piercy. We often hear that Exhibit A of toxic behavior is evangelical Christian men. But recent sociological studies tell a very different story. These studies find that family men who attend church regularly test out as the most loving husbands and the most engaged fathers. They have the lowest rate of divorce and the lowest rate of domestic violence of any group in America. The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes by Nancy Piercy, explodes anti-male stereotypes and shows that classic Christianity has the power to overcome toxic behavior and reconcile the sexes. To receive your copy of The Toxic War on Masculinity, just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
For decades, Hank Hanegraaff has shared the truth of the historic Christian faith by answering questions over the radio, defending the faith through the written word, and preaching from pulpits around the globe. Today, he is ready to share his life in Christ, as detailed in his most profoundly personal piece of penmanship to date, Truth Matters, Life Matters More. Hank feels closer to Christ than ever before and wants you to learn from his experiences, as recounted in Truth Matters, Life Matters More, so that you can join him on life's greatest journey, the journey toward union with God in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, The Unexpected Beauty of an Authentic Christian Life, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.
If you're not horrified, you should be, because the relentless assaults of wokeism on sanity and common sense have now reached a fevered pitch. In fact, some astute observers see more than deranged ideologies at work. It's as though the gates of hell have been opened. And alarmingly, the speed of this mindless rush to chaos and potential civilizational collapse is gaining momentum daily. That means Christians need to wake up, and wake up fast. One of the best alarm clocks is the upcoming special Woke edition of the Christian Research Journal. It contains sobering articles with penetrating analyses of a social disease that is reaching a flashpoint. To receive your copy of this special edition of the Christian Research Journal, visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI.
Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Nancy Piercy, in their conversation.
As men were no longer growing up in the farms, they were coming into the city and working at desk jobs, people began to worry that men were becoming emasculated. They were becoming soft and effeminate. And there was actually a new word that entered the English vocabulary. The new word was over-civilized. Men were becoming over-civilized, and they needed to find a way to recover their manhood. Unfortunately, the answer that many of them gave was that they needed to get away from civilization, away from their wives and children, out into nature, go out and be a cowboy, you know, roping cattle with the cowboys and sleeping under the stars, or frontier man, or a hunter, trapper, backwoodsman, and so on. And this was inspired partly by the romantic idea of the noble savage. The savage didn't have a negative connotation back then, by the way. But the noble savage who, you know, is because he's closer to nature, he's somehow more noble and more courageous than the poor civilized man in our Western society. And it was also driven, though, by Darwinism. You may have that question coming up, so I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it was also influenced by the rise of Darwinian thought, because Darwinian thinkers said your true nature is, you know, you're an animal. Right, you're basically a beast. The Darwinian thinkers began to argue that the men who came out on top in the struggle for survival would by necessity be ruthless, rugged, savage, barbarian, and even predatory. And so the way to recover your true manhood was by leaving civilization behind again and by discovering the beast within. This is when the Tarzan stories became popular, for example, and the son of the author says they were explicitly written to give fictional form to the idea that men are just part of the animal world. That's all we are. And so Tarzan, of course, he retains that inner wildness, that inner courage, because he's been raised by the apes. And even after he learns European customs and languages, he turns to Jane and he says, "I'm still a wild beast at heart." And of course, there was a more serious literature, too. There was a whole genre called literary naturalism, which also was giving fictional form to a Darwinian worldview. The best known is Jack London. And as a young man, he read Darwinian literature. He read Darwin's writings so thoroughly that he could quote passages by heart. And one historian said he experienced a conversion experience, what she called it, to radical materialism by reading Darwin. You know, his books are mostly about dogs, but they're intended as metaphors, of course, for human beings. And his message is human beings are products of natural selection, genes and environment. They have no real free will. And so between the noble savage and Darwinism, the idea grew that to find your true manhood, you need to get away from civilization, away from the influence of marriage and family. And I think this is a highly destructive message because it's essentially telling men your true nature is not in marriage and family. You know, it's getting away from it. That marriage, well, it's the Playboy message, right? Playboy specifically says your true self is not in marriage, but, you know, in your wild, free, adventuresome self, and that marriage ties you down and it's against your true nature. And so the way I counter that is with the cultural mandate. You know, about half my class doesn't know what cultural mandate is, but in Genesis, when God creates the universe, he creates the earth, he creates the trees and plants, he creates the animals, and then he finally creates the humans as the apex of his creation. And what's the first thing he says to them? First thing he does is tell them why he created them. You know, what's your purpose? Be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And in the streamlined language of Genesis, we can sort of unpack what that means. Be fruitful and multiply is not just your immediate family. Historically, all the social institutions grow out of the family. You know, it becomes a clan, becomes a village, becomes a nation. And of course, social institutions are formed for certain functions like the marketplace, the school, the state, and then the treaties and constitutions that govern these groups. So the entire social world is what we're called to develop in Genesis. Subdue the earth means harness the natural resources. So, of course, historically, it usually starts with farming, but also mining, technology, inventing computers, composing music. One of my students said, "Oh, come on, composing music." So I played the violin and I said, "What's the violin made out of? Wood? And what's the bow made out of? Horsehair. It's all the transcendent beauty that you associate with music starts with harnessing the natural resources, you know, in nature. So this is often called the cultural mandate, because what it means is that humans were originally created to create cultures, to create civilizations, to make history. And this is before the fall. So after the fall, you know, God has put us on a track. In sin, we fall off the track. In salvation, God puts us back on the track. But what was the track? You go back to before the fall, it's the cultural mandate. So men do not find their ultimate sense of masculinity by getting away from women and children and civilization. They find their ultimate fulfillment by rolling up their sleeves and digging deeply into their social responsibilities, starting with their family, and digging deeply into creative and productive work that serves other people.
I want to stay on the subject of Darwinism, but I want to ask you one sort of tangential question, and that is the Victorian Jesus, meek and mild. What does this have to do with the whole idea of toxic masculinity?
Yeah, so during the 19th century, a lot of Christians were becoming theologically liberal, meaning that they were starting to deny this supernatural element. The essence of liberalism is just to deny the supernatural. You know, Jesus wasn't really divine, Son of God. He was a moral exemplar, right? Or they denied the Trinity, for example, and they denied the miracles that Jesus did. They denied anything that was supernatural. They denied that the Bible was divine revelation. No, the Bible was just the best religious insights over the generations. You know, the people who wrote it, that was their insights. And so liberalism was getting rid of the content of Christianity, but they wanted to retain the feelings of religion, because religion gave them nice emotional feelings, emotional experiences. The first liberal theologian was Schleiermacher in Germany, and he redefined religion as the feeling of dependence. There you go. So as a result, liberalism became very emotional and focused primarily on emotional engagement. Correct doctrine didn't really matter, but good feelings mattered. And so you can see why liberalism then led to a very pale and sentimental, a sentimental vision of Jesus. Jesus becomes this pale, sweet, like you said, meek and mild. In fact, that was a song that was common at the Victorian age. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look on me, a little child. That was a prayer taught to children. And so as a result, people began to feel that Christianity was emasculating. You know, that Jesus himself was this almost effeminate character. And so there was a reaction against that. And I think a good reaction. I think it was an important course correction. Fundamentalism in the early 20th century stood against that, said, okay, we need to recover some sense of masculinity here. Christianity, you know, in opposition to liberalism, Christianity does care about correct doctrine. It does care about truth. And we need to be strong and bold in fighting for truth. And so the fundamentalists, in some ways, almost overcompensated, because they began to say Christianity is a manly religion. The manliest man is the man in the pulpit, because he has to be able to fight against, you know, heresy and liberalism. So there was, like I said, in many ways, it was a good course correction, because the fundamentalists said we want to have an alternative to that highly sentimental, almost effeminate style of liberalism. So I'm starting to wonder if I'm answering your question.
No, you are. You are. I mean, basically what I was driving at is here you have Jesus is meek and mild, but as you point out, meekness is not about being soft. Meekness is power under control. So you have this kind of whipsaw because people didn't understand the biblical language. And so you get a completely different impression of Christianity and certainly the Christ of Christianity.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good point. In my book, I do go to the word meek in the Greek. What did it mean in the first century? And it certainly didn't mean wimpy, you know, or soft. Meek was used by Greek writers at the time, Xenophon, I think it was, who used it of a war horse that was well-trained. That was what meek was. I mean, this is strength under control. Plato used it Plato and Aristotle both used it as a general who is kind to a conquered people. You know, if he's conquered the people, he has a right to just wipe them out. But no, he's kind to them. So that was the meaning. I pulled together some of those meanings that were from the first century to give us a notion of what the word meant back then. And you're right. Sort of the general meaning is not that you're weak. You're strong, but you know how to control it. You know how to channel it to do good.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Nancy Piercy. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes by Nancy Piercy. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more.
Hank Hanegraaff has dedicated his life to defending truth because truth matters. However, his life and ministry were radically transformed by another three-word phrase, life matters more. Truth matters because Christianity is rooted in history and evidence. Life matters more because it is the experience of union with God. The goal of Christian life is union with God. All attempts to understand Christianity from a solely rational perspective put us in danger of devolving into a transactional rather than transformational relationship with God. Truth Matters, Life Matters More will equip you to move beyond intellectually knowing about God to experientially knowing Him in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us online at equip.org.